Let's look together this afternoon at Romans chapter 12. Romans 12. And we want to look at three verses here, 6, 7, and 8. I think you're familiar with the context here. Let's read these verses. Romans 12, 6. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth with diligence. He that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. May the Lord bless His word to us today. We might ask, how did Paul know what the saints in Rome needed, encouragement and exhortation in? After all, he'd never been there. Of course, he knew some who had evidently migrated there. The list of names in chapter 16 certainly indicates that. But perhaps he received reports from people who were there or had been there. Perhaps just knowing what others elsewhere needed, he knew what the saints in Rome needed, because whatever is needed in one place is usually needed in another. What's needed in Corinth is probably needed in Rome. No doubt the Spirit of God led him to deal with the things he deals with and in the order in which he deals with them. Whatever the case, the first practical duty in detail set forth here in Romans 12 is the faithful use of gifts, abilities, capacities, talents, if you will. And what we've seen in the previous verses leading up to this, especially last Lord's Day, is Paul telling them in so many words, think of yourselves as a body. And that illustration of the human body is so fascinating to me. You have all these different parts and systems. Each one must be operating for the whole to exist, and to exist in good health, and to function, and for there to be life. Each functions for the good of the others. We used the term interdependence. I don't think we used the word teamwork, but that would certainly apply. The mutual benefit, and of course the warning right up front is, don't let yourself be puffed up because of the part that you play. Preserve the unity in the diversity. You know, we probably use our eyesight more than any other sense. But the eyes have no reason to be lifted up and boast against, say, the hands. We have two of each. What would the eye do without the hand? How would you rub the sleep out in the morning? Your eyes need your hands. Or maybe, how would you clean your glasses? You need your hands. The eyes need the hands. And of course, the hands need the eyes to be guided. And there's this mutual dependence and mutual benefit. And that's just a simple example. You could multiply that time and time again throughout the human body. And so it is with the Lord's body. His institution. We'll try not to turn over and read, but let me just remind you of what we saw in 1 Corinthians 12. Whether one member suffer, all the members suffer with it. Or if one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. And I know some of you have heard this illustration from me before, but those who haven't must hear it. I got this from dear brother Downing. He illustrates that the altogether suffering in this way. When you rear back with the hammer and you strike the wrong nail, do you just say, "Oh, poor nail, too bad. Hope he gets along okay." No. The whole body comes to help that injured thumb. Immediately, the other hand comes over to give support. And the knees bend, and the back bends. The voice cries out. The eyes water. The heart increases in its beating. Every part of the body comes to the aid of that one part. On the other hand, think of this. It says, if one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Think of what happens when, say, an athlete wins some competition. And there is rejoicing. And the whole body is involved. You know, maybe the hands come together or the hands clap. And, the fist is thrust in the air, the foot stomps. The whole body is taken up with the occasion, the event, and comes to rejoice with the other parts. And that is what or how a church should function. Coming to the aid of the needy, coming to rejoice with those who rejoice. But every member is to be a partaker and to enjoy and to be involved in serving the Lord by serving the Lord's people, serving one another in some way. Everyone can do something and should. Well, we have in verses 6 through 8 of Romans 12, first of all, a statement concerning God giving gifts to individuals that vary. Different gifts. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us. And these two lines we should not overlook or hasten by to get to the list of seven gifts that are mentioned here. I would just point out the very opening words of verse 6. Having then gifts. He doesn't say, you know, hoping to have, aspiring to have, but he says, you already have them. He doesn't say, you know, claim some gift, but recognize what God has given you. had a friend who goes to a rather goofy thing called a church that said, you know, our preacher was preaching on the gifts of the Spirit and told us to consider our gifts, and I think I would like to be a prophet. Well, the poor man missed the whole point. It isn't what do you want to have, it's what do you have. And I hope no one at the conclusion of our studies here in Romans 12 walks away with the idea, well, I think I want to be a prophet. If so, I've failed in my task. We're supposed to recognize what God has given us. We shouldn't assume that we have a gift that we don't have. On the other hand, we ought not deny what God has given us, as I said earlier, in some sort of artificial humility. It may help to talk to others who may help us recognize or who may confirm what gift or gifts that we may have. And certainly there's something to be said about being fitted for some work or type of service by God-given temperament and just by some ability you're born with. You know, those that are born with a mechanical mind, well, when they become a Christian, they still have a mechanical mind. And they can use that and they can channel that then in a way in which they might be able to help a brother or sister, you know, that doesn't know how to change a light bulb. Or you know, some of these light bulbs are getting kind of complicated anyway. Or work on a vehicle or something like that. What are you fitted to do? You know, some people don't know how to use a broom. Well, if you know how to use a broom, there might be a place to use that gift. And I'm being a little oversimplistic, but I hope you see the point. Once again, in 1 Corinthians 12, we read, "But all these worketh that one and the selfsame Spirit, dividing to every man severally or individually as he will." It is the Spirit of God who bestows gifts and who gives abilities and enablements. And we should see the sovereignty of God then in the gifts that we have. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us. And I'll say a little more about that, Lord willing, as we conclude. But let's go ahead and look at these seven gifts and the word that is given to encourage in the use or to guide the use of them. First of all is prophecy. Prophecy, as far as I can tell here, is the only extraordinary apostolic type gift in this list. In 1 Corinthians 12, the emphasis there is upon the extraordinary and the temporary, the first century apostolic gifts. Most of what Paul mentions here seems to be what we would call ordinary, though that doesn't mean that they're to be despised in any way. And in fact, they are the gifts that continue on. This is the kind of the exception here in this list, it seems. There were no apostles in Rome, as far as we know. And so prophets were certainly needed at this stage of the development of the early church in Rome. Prophets in the assembly would receive direct communication from the Holy Spirit, and they would deliver that communication to the people of God. Unlike apostles, the ministry of prophets was evidently more occasional, whereas, you know, the apostolic ministry was more constant, it seems. But he says, if you have the gift of prophecy, then prophesy according to the proportion of faith. And this is not the same word, but it's very similar to the phrase at the end of verse 3, the measure of faith, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. And there's some discussion about exactly what this phrase is talking about. Perhaps it means that some might exercise the gift of prophecy more than others. And, you know, there were perhaps prophets and prophets, and some who prophesied, you know, every week, and some that prophesied maybe once a month or something, or that prophesied more profoundly, had a deeper revelation given to them, the measure or the proportion of their gift and their faith. Some think that the point here is that the objective faith, being what was written revelation thus far, would be the measure or the standard by which prophets would be assessed and their prophecies would be received. And the word proportion here is literally the word analogy, according to the analogy of faith. And we use that phrase today to speak of the whole consistent system of truth that has been revealed. And this would enable hearers to discern true prophecy from false prophecy. Well, you can do some digging on that on your own. Secondly, is ministry. Of course, this is the word for deacon. Perhaps what's in view here is one who has the gifts necessary for the office of deacon. Here's a person who knows how to serve tables, knows how to help widows, etc., who is gifted for that kind of work. And he says, if that's what God has enabled you to do, then do it. Ministry on ministering. We might say, let the deacons deek. Similarly with teaching there in verse 7. Some have a gift of analyzing, explaining, in ways that others can understand, maybe even what we would think of as sort of a ministry, a mentoring gift. And this teaching would not be revelatory like prophecy, but rather the fruit of diligent study and preparation, not a miraculous apostolic type of gift. And he says, if that's the gift you have, if you have a teaching gift, then teach. Don't hide your talent in a napkin. Put it to work. And the church should recognize such gifts and should provide opportunities for the use and development of them. Those with a teaching gift do not always exercise it publicly. You know, we have a beautiful example of that in Acts chapter 18, where Aquila and Priscilla have a conversation, or maybe quite a few conversations, with Apollos and instruct him in the ways of the Lord more fully. Evidently, they both had some teaching gift that they exercised, because both the husband and the wife are mentioned there in that passage. Let me be quick to say, we don't read of Priscilla in the pulpit preaching or teaching, of course. Number four is exhortation, verse 8. This is literally, it's the word parakaleo, to comfort, to encourage, to exhort. And in some contexts, it's a call to action, or having a gift to urge to action. And that seems to be what our translators here took it to mean. We know that both exhortation and what was mentioned before, teaching, are requirements for elders, according to 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, a bishop or an elder must be, among other things, able to teach, have an aptitude for teaching. And then in the next chapter, Paul says to Timothy personally, "Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine." And we take this to be the public reading of Scripture, the public teaching of the Word of God, and the applying of it in exhortation. But these are not just gifts that elders or bishops alone have in some degree, in some measure or proportion of faith. Others have a gift to exhort. I'm so thankful for some exhortations I've received one-on-one from some dear friends who would never think of setting a foot in a pulpit. In teaching, the mind is addressed. In exhortation, the will is addressed. And we need both. And some have more of a gift for one than the other. Either way. Number five, giving. Giving. Well, and we take this to mean financial giving. Well, to have the gift of giving, at least it would seem to be most likely that the Lord has given a person more resources with which to give than he's given to others. Now, it is, of course, true that everyone should give something. And, you know, Paul tells about the churches of Macedonia that had nothing to give, and they still gave anyway. It's a very gripping and touching thing that he says there. But there are some who have more resources than others, and certainly those who have them should use them and make that spiritual investment for the glory of God. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. And the word simplicity here may emphasize pure motives, sincere motives, not any double motives, not any for any recognition on his part and so on. But as the Lord said, not letting one hand know what the other gives, not blowing a horn in the street and so on. Or the word may be emphasizing the degree. He that giveth, let him do it liberally, bountifully. not in a stingy way. Let me remind you of what Paul says here in 1 Timothy on this whole subject. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded. Well, that goes right along with Romans 12, doesn't it? Nor trust in uncertain riches. If you trust in your riches, you're trusting in a very shaky foundation. But to trust in the living God who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute. And that ready to distribute may be a kind of an expanded explanation of the word simplicity here in Romans 12:8. Ready to impart, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, and so on. Well, number six is ruling. He that ruleth with diligence. The ruling here would most likely refer to pastors or overseers, elders, those who lead the flock of God. In 1 Corinthians 12:28, one of the gifts that's mentioned is what's called governments. That might be a parallel to ruling here, governing, guiding, leading. He that ruleth should rule with diligence. Diligence here means earnest care. Not in a harsh manner, but gently. Not neglecting the work on the one hand, and not overdoing it on the other hand. As Peter says, not being a lord over God's heritage, but recognizing that Jesus is the chief shepherd. It may be just a very loose paraphrase there of what Peter says in 1 Peter 5, is not an overlord, but an under-shepherd. He that ruleth, let him rule with diligence, with earnest care. And then number seven, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. The gift of mercy. You know, I, the longer I live, the more convinced I am that if you have a gift, you assume everybody has it. And it's not that way. If you have the gift of mercy, you think everybody should have the gift of mercy. Everybody has the gift. They just don't know it. Well, it wouldn't be mentioned here if it were not indeed a gift. There are some people who are especially enabled by God to put themselves in the shoes of others. And maybe they've been in those shoes. If they haven't, they can imagine what it would be like to be in someone else's shoes. And they can be compassionate. They can give sympathy. And there are some who just don't have a great deal of that gift. I suppose every Christian surely has some. We're all commanded to be merciful as our Father in heaven is merciful. But there is something to be said for the gift of mercy here. A special capacity and ability to sympathize with the afflicted. I'm thinking of a conversation from years ago when a friend said concerning a third party, he said, he's not the person that you go to when you're discouraged and need an uplift, but he's the person you go to when you need a kick in the seat of the pants. Well, some have the gift of kicking, I guess. But what's mentioned here is the gift of mercy. And those who have that gift should exercise it with cheerfulness. And this is similar to what we read concerning giving in another passage in 2 Corinthians, where Paul says, God loves a cheerful giver. And the idea of cheerfulness, or this term translated cheerfulness in these passages, is readiness, eagerness, not having to be forced and prodded into the exercise of mercy, but, you know, overflowing, we might say, being eager and ready to show mercy. Well, let me hasten on to some observations here. First of all, there's no doubt that this is not meant to be a complete list. This list could go on much longer. This is simply a sampling. And Paul is throwing out these, by inspiration, throwing out these different gifts and even types of gifts to prompt our thinking and the thinking of his readers to consider, you know, what do I have? All these gifts are different. Every member of the assembly has different gifts, gifts differing according to the grace that's given to us. The New Testament church is not a machine with mass-produced parts . Rather, it is an organic body with living members, not clones, all just alike in every way, but with individual personalities, styles, backgrounds, likes and dislikes. We're all gifted in some way, and just as certainly we are all weak in other ways. And where we are weak is where we need a brother or sister who is strong to balance us out, even as we balance them out. There's mutual. That's what a body does. It's things that the eye can do, the hand can't do. And so on. Vice versa. Variety is good. It's God's method. It's only non-living machines that have machine-produced parts. We are not all called to Sunday morning pulpit work. But the behind-the-scenes work is just as vital as that which is more visible. And let me just say this. There has been a terrible confusion and error, mostly in a previous generation, but we still have some of it in our thinking today, that if you really want to serve God, you've got to be a pastor or a missionary. That's it. If you're not a pastor or a missionary, then you're just a second-class Christian. Nothing could be further from the truth, beloved. And under that kind of philosophy, far too many were rushed into so-called full-time service who should not have been. And I read somewhere recently that we are not all full-time full-time in the ministry, but we are full-time Christians, or we are full-time in our labor for the Lord, or something to that effect. if you dig ditches for the glory of God. Take that as your God-given calling and gift and dig the best ditches that were ever dug. Digged. Is that the right word? The labor that is done for the Lord, regardless of how invisible it is nonetheless necessary in the overall picture for the Lord to be glorified through the functioning of His body on earth. Now you may look at this list of seven and say, well, I don't have any of these. It doesn't look like I'm here. Well, then what do you have? What can you do well? What do you have an aptitude for God's glory and for the good of others, especially for the good of those in your assembly? Whatever it is, use it. Do it diligently. Do it for the glory of God. And do it with humility, as we were reminded right up front in verse 3. Another observation is this. There's something no doubt to be said for developing your gift. Paul says to Timothy, stir up the gift that is in thee. He wasn't talking about reaching for a gift he didn't have. He already had this gift. But he says, now, stir it up. Don't let it get stale. Keep it burning. Fan it into flame. And we should all be, I think the word is honing our gifts, seeking to sharpen them and improve them as we use them. Don't let them die out and burn out and be left on the shelf. Well, this passage teaches us that we all need each other. God did not intend that Christians be independent and isolated. He gave an institution that gives, I was about to say socialism, that gives social structure. And opportunity. Let me say it this way. The Christian life coincides with church life. That's not to say that salvation is in a church. But it is to say that healthy growth and development and service requires church. This is God's institution given for this purpose, to be an outlet to serve and to be a source to receive, or from which to receive. I've heard these brothers on the Founders podcast say repeatedly this word of advice, and it's worth repeating. The best advice they can give to a Christian or even a father of a family is build your life around a local church. And having said that, let me hasten to say this. And I mentioned this before, but I want to hit it again here. Every assembly is composed with God-given parts. Each assembly, by God's providence, has what it needs at that moment. Each assembly is a complete body. And certainly, you know, bigger assemblies need more gifts, and so on. And so the Lord makes it all proportional. But I would underscore this. A church does not have to be big to be good. But what it does have to be good is to have each member functioning at full capacity. Well, how are we doing? May God help us to be a good church, to function and play our part, do our part at full capacity by God's grace and for God's glory. Last of all, in the instructions that he gives here in verses 6 through 8, in several instances, he just repeats a form of the same word. And so what's the point? Well, whatever your gift, use it. Give the best effort that you can. Give it your all. Give God your all. I will close today with the words of Robert Haldane commenting here on this passage. He says simply this: it is the duty of all to spend and be spent in the service of their Lord. May God help us to do that.